Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah. It's that real this time around. Technique. Revolutionary Volume 2. It's on now, motherfucker. Lock and load. This is the point of no return. I can never go back. Life without parole. Upstate, shackled and trapped. Living in the hole. Looking at the world through a crack. But fuck that. I'd rather shoot it out than get clapped. I've gone too far. There ain't no coming back for me. Auschwitz gas chamber full of Zyklon B. Just like the Spanish exterminating Tainos. Raping the black and Indian women. Creating Latinos. Motherfuckers made me out of self-righteous hatred. And now you got yourself a virus. Stuck in the matrix. A suicide bomber. Strapped and ready to blow. Lethal injection. Strapped down. Ready to go. Don't you understand? They'll never let me live out in peace. Concrete jungle. Guerrilla war out in the streets. Nat Turner with the sickle. Pitchfork and machete. The end of the world. Motherfucker, you not ready. This is the point of no return. And nobody can stop it. Malcolm Little when he knelt before Elijah Muhammad. The comet that killed the dinosaurs changing the earth. They love to criticize, they always say I changed for the worse. Like prescription pills when you misusing them, nigga. The Templar Knights when they took Jerusalem, nigga. And figured out what was buried under Solomon's temple. Al-Aqsa, the name is not coincidental. I know too much, the government is trying to murder me. No coming back like cutting your wrists open vertically. How could the serpent be purposely put in charge of the country? Genetic engineered sickness spread amongst me. My people are so hungry that they attack without reason. Like a fucking dog ripping off the hand that feeds them. Immortal technique is treason to the Patriot Act. So come and get me, motherfucker, cause I'm not coming back. This is the point from which I can never return. And if I back down now, then forever I burn. This is the point from which I can never retreat. Cause if I turn back now, there can never be peace. This is the point from which I will die, succeed, live in the struggle. I know I'm alive when I bleed. From now on, it can never be the same as before. Cause the place that I'm from doesn't exist anymore. This is the point of no return, nigga. You better believe this. Mary Magdalene giving birth to the children of Jesus. The evolution of the world, bloody and dramatic. Human beings killing monkeys to conquer the planet. The kingdoms of Africa and Mesopotamia. Machine gunning your body with depleted uranium. This is the age of microchips and titanium. The dark side of the moon in contact with aliens. I started out like Australians, criminal minded. Broke into hell, tore it down and built a city behind it. Southpaw, murderous methodology, nigga. Remember that I'm just a man, don't follow me, nigga. Cause once you pass the point, you can never go home. You gotta face the possibility of dying alone. So tell me, motherfucker, how could you die for the throne when you don't even got the fucking heart to die for your own? It rains acid, one day the earth will cry from a stone. And you'll be looking at the world living inside of a dome. Computerized humanity living inside of a clone. This is the place where the unknown is living and real. Wormwood, the planet X and the seven seal. Universal truth is not measured in mass appeal. This is the last time that I kneel and pray to the sky. Cause almost everything that I was ever told was a lie. This is the point from which I can never return. And if I back down now, then forever I burn. This is the point from which I can never retreat. Cause if I turn back now, there can never be peace. This is the point from which I will die, succeed, live in the struggle. I know I'm alive when I bleed. From now on, it can never be the same as before. Cause the place that I'm from doesn't exist anymore.
However it starts, it's got to be loud, and then it's got to get.
We just started the show, right?
Like, you didn't miss
about anything in the silence.
No, nothing. No, that's actually kind of true.
Yeah, we're really
talking. We've been talking out of our asses for about 20 minutes.
It's been a fucking shitty week.
It's been rough.
It's been a bad news week, really. There just hasn't been enough fucking evil repression and shit going on.
I know. God, I'm jonesing.
I just wish there were some kind of fucking war we could talk about or something.
I know. Yeah. 30,000 troops being sent to something.
Oh,
somewhere.
God. So last week,
nobody cares about that war.
Right. Or any other war, really.
No, seriously. I mean, who cares?
Right.
I don't.
I'm not joking.
I'm really not.
All right, so, start from the top. How the fuck are you?
I'm well. Hi, honey. I told her I would say hello on the radio.
Hi, Randy.
Hi. I'm gonna tell the story now. This is my smug asshole of the week story, if you guys don't mind hearing it. So I was wearing my Dharma Initiative shirt the other day, and this guy was like, "Hey, man, I like your shirt." And I was like, "Yeah, thanks, bro. Man, what's up with the smoke monster, right? I mean, is it like a fucking like time correcting itself? I mean," and he's looking at me kind of confused. And he's like, "Oh, no. The symbol on your shirt, it's from the I Ching. The I Ching, yeah." And I'm like, "No, it's from the Dharma Initiative on Lost." Now, I know many Asian people borrowed from Lost to develop.
Maybe the I Ching is copywriting.
Yeah, I mean, you know, J.J. Abrams open about his ideas and other people borrowing them, but I get my philosophy from TV. "Ooh, that's a symbol and it means you fuck off, shitbag." Am I right? What a dick. Right?
Yeah, you know, and I hear a lot of people that talk about philosophy talk about John Locke, and I'm like, he only has like five lines of show.
Yeah.
I don't see what the deal is.
No, but, exactly. I mean, is he dead? Is he not? I mean, does the I Ching talk about that? No, it doesn't.
Honestly, and I mean, if we consult the I Ching, are we going to know what that cloud of smoke was? And
what
the fuck was that cloud of smoke?
That is what I'm saying. I don't know. I've written theories about this shit. I'm really not kidding.
We don't watch TV because
we're anarchists. Fuck TV.
Bullshit. It's just a part of the system to operate.
Fuck Heroes.
Mind waves.
Fuck Heroes season 2. It sucked. 3 and 4 totally rebounded.
I told you it
sucked. I know. Season 2 is bad. Yeah. You can skip that one.
Anyway, let's get on to
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so in somewhat local news, so I guess this is... this isn't just important for the local people here. This is important for people listening at home because they can't be effective. Daniel Wilson is he's a political prisoner in Olympia, Washington. He's in jail. He's vegan. And he's got a hunger strike because they haven't been able to give him food. They refuse to give him the food that he says he requires, vegan food. And so he really needs a lot of support coming in. And I know that a lot of people don't really give a shit about making phone letters. But this is an effective tool to use for prisoner support. A lot of times in this community, we get really ideological in the way that we act, and we think that any action that doesn't include a brick isn't worthy. But it's simply not the case. When we do have comrades in prison, it is very important to be constantly policing the prison system, because they'll get away with murder, literally, if we're not watching them every minute of every day. And solidarity doesn't just end when the block breaks up on the street. It has to extend to our community that's in prison. In fact, it's probably more important that we focus on a lot of those people, because they are in constant threat, whereas we have a lot of freedoms and privileges that we can make use of out here. These people are sitting in a cell all day. They really need our support. And beyond just the physical aspect, I know the spiritual aspect of knowing you have a community out there that has your fucking back is imperative when you're in jail. It's one of the most important things that keeps you going. And a lot of times we see a lot of burnout from people, political prisoners who go to jail and don't receive support from their community and come out disenchanted and don't really give a shit about any movement anymore because they weren't supported. And that makes sense. I mean, if you don't have support from somebody, how the fuck are you going to fight along with them? Basically, if you don't know how to laugh with somebody and love with somebody, you can't fight next to somebody.
Yeah, and I mean, these are virtuous, wonderful, you know, fighters out there who are being put into a system that's essentially, I mean, it's, you know, I always say, slavery never went anywhere. It just became the prison industry. And so, I mean, wrap your mind around that. I mean, we're kind of abstractly slaves out here, but you're directly a slave in there, and what that does to your mind and to your spirit.
Right, and that extends beyond just being in the prison walls. I mean, if you go to Jack in the Box on third shift, half the people there are on work release, meaning they have to work to stay out of jail. That's slavery. Yeah, that's the kind of the definition of it. Either you work or we punish you.
Right.
And we all are punished because we have to pay rent, and rent is another form of tools used by the slavery. But here's what you can do for listeners out there and listeners in here. You can call the Thurston County Jail, flood their phone lines with complaints and requests to get Daniel some vegan food, and the phone number to call is 360-786-5510. I'll repeat it again one more time. It's 360-786-5510. And they say to the best time to call is between 1:30 and 4:30 p.m. Pacific time. because that's when the offices are most busy, and it really annoys the shit out of them to get these phone calls asking for vegan food, specifically when they're most busy and waiting to go home. So call them, bug them. Daniel Wilson needs vegan food, so that's something we can do to show a small bit of solidarity. Daniel was arrested, by the way, in the 2008 May Day riots of Olympia. He was charged with misdemeanors and I believe a couple of felonies as well. So that's to give you a small background. I don't know Daniel personally, so I can't say that he's any good at Connect Four or anything like that. But I can say that he's a comrade that's in lockdown and making a simple phone call. If that helps him in any way, then fuck your ideology. Make the phone call.
And earlier when we were doing our practice 15 minutes where we didn't broadcast anything live, because that was warm up. The Dakota people are occupying the land being auctioned off by the IRS in protest. And if you want to help in any way, you can send cash to, they can't do checks right now, you can send cash to Crow Creek Sioux Tribe, attention Chairman Brandon Sazu, S-A-Z-U-E, P.O. Box Fort Thompson, South Dakota. Yeah, you can mail cash. They don't have a...
Yeah, the reason that they can't take checks is because they're getting busted right now. The reason their land is getting auctioned off is the IRS is popping them and for land taxes that they shouldn't owe because the land is rightfully theirs under the treatise that was signed. But the IRS is claiming that land was sold and rebought by them or gifted back to them. Therefore, they owe property tax on reservation land, which is a breach of contract. But I mean, who gives a shit about contracts, right? I mean... They're just poor people anyway. We could tell them where we want them to live. But these people have decided to take it back. And they can't take checks because any check goes to the banking system and the IRS can track it. And so they just need cash donations right now. Basically, it's freezing cold weather in South Dakota. I don't know if anybody knows about South Dakota, but it's really open space. It's fucking endless miles of open space. And it's really boring on a train. But it's really cold and really windy, and these people are living out in these fields, 7,000 acres they're occupying. And I've been in occupations before of, like, you know, two-story houses, and it's hard enough to secure a two-story house. Imagine how fucking impossible it must feel to secure 7,000 acres.
I mean, how do you even begin? The logistics alone are insane, especially when there's, I mean, how many people, a few hundred maybe, attempting to do that themselves. So, P.O. Box 50, Fort Thompson, South Dakota, 57339. Or you can call the tribal chairman's secretary, Carol Kilt, at 605-245-2221. I think money orders would...
Maybe you should call them, contact them...
Yeah, it's 605-245-2221.
Yeah, and let them know. This is also an interesting occupation because they're actually... the Crow Creek Sioux are actually inviting anybody to come join the occupation. Meaning we could hop a train right now get in a car, get in a bus, however we want to get there. We could get there and be a part of the occupation. And this is the reason I say this is rare is because a lot of indigenous actions, they request that it's within the autonomy of the indigenous communities, and that's for a lot of the indigenous security culture. It's a self-sustaining, self-reliance idea that this fight is theirs. But they clearly understand that this fight is not just their fight. This is a fight for the land, not just for the ownership of the land, but the protection of the land, because this is prime space to put in wind power. And wind power sounds great, right? Like it's going to get us off oil, right? And it's going to take care of all of our problems, not to kill people in Iraq. But the downside of wind power in this situation is it's going to be completely decimating and destroying a large, large portion of land that is subsistence land for indigenous people to survive off of. Let's keep in mind that any of these tools of industry for power are inherently going to suck in resources and destroy. There's going to be output. Anytime you create electricity or create power of any sort, there is a downside to that. And the vast amount of power that's going to be created is going to create waste. It's going to destroy. On top of that, private companies are the ones who are going to be profiting in the billions from this wind power. It's not going to profit the Crow Creek, who is one of the poorest reservations in existence right now. Pine Ridge Reservation being the most impoverished community in the nation. Crow Creek Sioux Tribe is second, I believe, at this point. So all of this money on their land is not going to be going to take care of them at all. In fact, they're being charged $2 million to put those wind towers in. So just some background on...
Why the Wind by Michael Franklin.
Fuck the wind.
Fuck power. Fuck wind power.
Man, that's rough.
I'm trying to pump up here.
I know. I'm
how about we get some music? Levis, you want to come up and play some music?
Live.
Yeah. All right, so everybody, Muddy Waters, put your hands together. We're going to welcome up one of your friends and a new friend of mine. I heard him play at the open mic a couple weeks ago. Wonderful. And so he's kind enough to come share it tonight. Leviticus, you should go by Leviticus. It's Leviticus Appleton. He's going to play a couple Portland resident and musician. And so let's just make sure we get his mics all going on here. Everybody put your hands together for Leviticus Appleton. Love it. Wow, the crowd of thousands roar. This is radio. They don't know I'm lying out there. That's Leviticus Appleton. Leviticus, what's the song called?
My songs don't really have names. I usually reference them with some word, but I forgot right now. How about Sunrise?
That sounds good. You said that word a couple times.
Yeah, I said that one at least twice, so that'll be it.
Awesome. Well, thanks for joining us tonight. You're going to be back later to play another song, right?
Yep. Thank you.
Beautiful. All right, so tonight we're going to be talking... are focusing our talk, trying to focus our talk. Anybody that's heard the show more than once knows that we really have trouble focusing anything. But we're going to try to focus our talk around police and pig culture and what the history of repression is, what it is now. I mean, we all have ideas about how the police repression affects us personally. But we're going to talk about a little bit of theory and also a little bit of action and the things going on with Christian. Christian is the author. You can see it if you're online. You can see the book and the link to purchase it on the radio show's webpage there. So click on that. But the book is called
That'll work.
Our Enemies in Blue, Power, Police and Power in America. And you can go to ChristianWilliams.com. That's Christian with a K. To check that out. First, though, I'm going to play this clip for everybody to listen to. Christian's joining us. Everybody, give it up for Christian. He's sitting up here. This is Christian Williams. We'll talk
about anything. Yeah.
We'll talk a little more about what Christian does and why we wanted to talk to him tonight in a moment. I'm going to play this clip. Some people listening in the interweb world, you remember a segment we used to do called Anarchy Now, and this segment was recorded shortly after the execution of Oscar Grant in the BART station in Oakland and the subsequent uprising of the people. And this episode of Anarchy Now, we inspect a little bit about the police, our resentment, anger, and actions being taken against the police. This is a pretty rough segment, so it's somewhat emotional, and there's some shit in it that you don't want to hear. But it's important to be heard, I think. So I'm going to play this clip, and then we'll get into the discussion. This is Anarchy Now, number 2, from over a year ago. Fuck the police.
In New York, the shooting of another unarmed black man raises further questions about NYPD tactics. On Thursday, an undercover police officer shot and killed Patrick Dorsman.
Today on Anarchy Now, putting the rad back in radio, police violence, root of uprising in Greece, but what about us?
Fascism doesn't just rule with the boot anymore. Economic terrorism, capitalism, has it failed us or are things going as planned?
PD officers were acquitted last month in the shooting of unarmed African immigrant Amadou Diallo.
Cases like the shooting deaths of Taisha Miller in Riverside, California, and Amadou Diallo in New York City have received national attention, but there are thousands of others whose deaths are not publicized and never hear about the real circumstances of their killing.
Police violence. The term itself almost seems redundant. In today's political climate and economic crises looming, we see a larger and larger amount of police violence taking place in our American streets. A recent report shows that about 9,500 people nationally were killed by police during the years 1980 to 2005. That's an average of nearly one fatal shooting per day. Nearly all of these killings have gone by with no ado from the media. However, this week in Oregon, a bank bombing in Woodburn has sent a shockwave through the media, calling out for a nation to mourn the death of two police officers. So two pigs die, and all of a sudden, we must mourn their deaths, while 9,500 people that were killed by police go by with no remorse. Now, 9,500, that's an interesting number. In fact, it's about three times the amount of people killed in the September 11th attacks. Now, how did we justify their deaths? With the vengeance and murder of 716,760 people in Afghanistan and Iraq, not including the 1,397,255 people that have been seriously injured. Perhaps we don't mourn the names of those who are dead in Afghanistan and Iraq because we cannot pronounce them. I mean, how can you mourn something if you cannot identify? Well, we've done a little digging and found that the Stolen Lives Project has helped us out just a little bit. What you're about to hear are the names of just a few cases of American citizens killed by pigs on patrol.
Nicholas Haywood Jr., African American, was shot and killed on September 29, 1994, by a New York City housing cop while Nicholas was playing with a toy gun. He was 13 years old.
On January 12, 1995, police shot two Puerto Rican youths, Anthony Rosero, 18 years old, and Hilton Vega, 21, while they were lying face down on the floor. Anthony was shot 14 times. Hilton was shot 8 times. The officers were former bodyguards of New York City Mayor Giuliani. No charges were filed.
Mario Miranda, a 26-year-old man from Mexico, was killed on June 12, 1992, in Nogales, Arizona, along the U.S.-Mexico border.
Danette Strawberry Daniels, a 31-year-old African-American woman who was killed on June 7, 1997 by Newark, New Jersey police who claimed they arrested her for dealing drugs and had to shoot her after a scuffle broke out in the squad car. Witnesses say Strawberry, who was pregnant, wasn't buying drugs, and protests erupted on the spot when she was shot dead.
Alicio Santos Carmona, 24 years old, Mexican, died of injuries on January 23, 1996, after he fell off a cliff near the border with Mexico while being chased by immigration agents at night.
Jared Faye Benito, a 16-year-old Filipino, was shot dead on June 7, 1996 in Pearl City, Hawaii.
Jorge Guillan, a 40-year-old man from Honduras, was killed on October 3, 1995, after family members called 911 and Chicago police responded. Jorge was suffering from schizophrenic hallucinations and holding a 2x4 to keep the door shut. Police threw him to the floor, beat his head with a flashlight, and handcuffed him. One cop stepped on the back of Jorge's neck. He died of asphyxiation, face down, in a pool of his own blood.
Aaron Williams, African-American, was killed on June 4, 1995 in San Francisco when police asked him to come outside his home for questioning about a burglary. When he did, police swarmed him, ramming his head into a wall. 12 cops brought him to the ground, hog-tied, beat him, and pepper-sprayed him. One cop kicked him so hard it left a boot print. A surgical mask was placed over his nose and mouth to keep the pepper spray in. He was thrown into the back of a police van and left in the police station's parking lot where he died.
Corey CeeLo Footman was 19 years old when he was drowned on April 8, 1997, after Miami-Dade police chased him into Snake Creek Canal at Buccaneer Park in Miami, Florida.
On August 9, 1997, Abner Louima, a Haitian immigrant, was arrested outside the Rendezvous Club in Brooklyn, New York. He was beaten in the squad car with fists and police radios. At the station house, he was raped with a bathroom plunger that was then forced into his mouth. The officer who did this reportedly bragged that he had to break a man.
Angelo Castro Jr., Puerto Rican, was beaten, abused with racial assaults, and told by Chicago police he'd be killed if he didn't move away. His family moved. Angel returned to the neighborhood for a friend's birthday party. After leaving the party, a police car rammed him as he rode his bike. As Angel tried to get up, police shot and killed him.
It's important to note that this is state-mandated violence, not random. Police are not the criminals we see in the corporate media. However, they are the long arm of capitalist neo-fascism. The WTO in 1999 is a perfect example of this. 50,000 people took on 250 of the wealthiest in the world, and the pigs turned their fire against the majority to protect and serve capital. To illustrate this, how about a quote from a rich white guy? This Constitution shall be designed to protect the opulent minority from the majority. No, not Bill O'Reilly, but founding fucking fascist James Madison. This brings into question the current economic crisis. Is capitalism a failure, or is it just built this way? The Federal Reserve System was built in 1913 by J.P. Morgan. It's based on debt. The government can give $700 billion, $500 million.
$1 million.
Debt is the center of the current housing foreclosures. Foreclosures being the cause of the unrest. The pigs are the silencer. This is the case of the pigs being Johnny Long Arm of the law, which follows the golden rule. Those who have the gold make the rules.
Six revolutions per minute. This is my regular speed. So how do you want me to live with it? How do you want me to live with it? Without ringing all alarms, without overflowing cars, without emptying the bars, without dueling with your cars. Six revelations per minute. This is my regular need. So how do you want me to live with it? How do you want me to live with it? Doing ringing all alarms, without overflowing cars, without emptying the bars, without dueling with your cars. I'm gathering new generation that's gonna stand up to it. To this karaoke, karaoke dictatorship. Where folders and models and guitars, boogie to the shit for bits. I make a better rock revolution alone with my dick.
And now with our global resistance report, solidarity with Greece.
From our comrades at Bombs and Shields, who can be found at bombsandshields.blogspot.com. In Greece, two officers who were arrested for the murder of Alexis Grigoropoulos were presented before an Athens judge today as rioters outside hurled Molotov cocktails at the courthouse. Sporadic bouts of rioting continued for the fifth consecutive day in both the capital, the port city of Thessalonica, and more than eight other cities. In Athens, more than 400 businesses had been burned out or vandalized.
Rome, Italy. The solidarity demonstration in Rome culminated in the overturning of cars, burning barricades, and a fierce battle with riot police outside the Greek embassy.
In Germany, dozens of solidarity demonstrations, some spontaneous, were held in cities throughout the country. Protesters in solidarity with Alexis attacked a bank and destroyed city property in Frankfurt, which has a sizable Greek population. Monday's embassy occupation in Berlin ended after 8 hours when the police promised safe passage to demonstrators. Another demonstration was in Dresden, attacked a courthouse, leaving broken windows and graffiti.
New York City. A hooded individual who left the scene on a yellow BMX bicycle threw bricks through a window at the Greek consulate around 4 a.m. Graffiti was also painted on buildings, including an anarchist symbol and the words, "Alex was here, murderers," and what appears to be the word "burn." Though the connection seems a bit of a stretch, authorities believe that the vandalism may have been the work of the bicycle bomber, who threw small bombs at the Mexican and British consulates, and last year bombed the Army Recruitment Center at Times Square. Later in the day, an anarchist organized solidarity protest was held outside the damaged consulate, which was closed for the day due to the attack. Police Commissioner Ray Kelly said that the accident is being investigated as a hate crime.
Moscow, Russia. An unknown individual threw a firebomb at the Greek consulate building today, igniting a small blaze that had to be extinguished by embassy staff. An eyewitness described the attacker as a young man between 18 and 20 years old.
And finally, Istanbul, Turkey. Anarchists held a demonstration outside the Greek consulate and left the building covered in red paint and an anarchy symbol outside.
This information was, as always, pirated from Democracy Now!, various indie media sources, with music from Gogol Bordello and La Tigre.
Special thanks to the Franklin House crew and Mike Cannon for inspiration. This is Rabble Rouser
and Reverend Dr. Mason Bilderberg
reminding you to fuck shit up and do it all
for love.
We might not be back. I might be in jail. I might be anywhere. But when I leave, you can remember I said with the last words on my lips that I am... a revolutionary.
Back, folks. All right, so that was Anarchy Now, and I was listening. I forgot that we had done Greek Solidarity Reports on that episode. That episode was a year ago this week, actually, and it's funny how a year has passed, and all that information is still pertinent. I mean, the riots are still occurring in Greece a year later. The police murdered Alex Grigoropoulos, and you know, that's one of the things. Christian's on the show now. Christian, you want to say hi?
Hey.
Hey, everybody. So one of the things I want to talk about is, and I don't know if you feel comfortable talking about this or not, but the difference between police in America and the violence that they get away with here versus what happens in other countries when the police exert themselves violently in the streets.
Well, it's hard to talk about in quantifiable terms because the measurement of police violence in the U.S. in particular is so sort of shaky. However, we could talk a little bit about the political culture as far as, you know, acceptable violence and the kind of response that it tends to initiate. I mean, this is totally anecdotal, but I was in London a couple years ago, and I went to see the Old Bailey, which is the courthouse, and, you know, I just got in line and went into the first courtroom that was there, and expected, you know, I would stick around for like 20 minutes or so, and it would probably be boring, but I would see, you know, the guys in the funny wigs and the robes
and the place that was blown up in V for Vendetta and all that. Yeah,
exactly. A few minutes in, I realized I had no idea what was going on with this trial, and I was confused about who the defense was and whatever. And so but clearly it was a big deal because it was full of media. So that evening I went home and I turned on the TV, and it turned out that this was the police on trial for having killed somebody. And it was this huge fucking deal. I mean, the particular incident was made international news anyway because, you know, they thought they had unearthed this terrorist cell, and then they shot this guy as he was on his way to work, and they totally had the wrong guy. It was a disaster. But there was a criminal trial against the police per se, and I was expressing shock about this.
And it was a serious trial.
When the police have trials here, we see
the images from the courts. The police are basically laughing themselves in and out of the court order they're going to get off. I mean,
but it's so rare for it to even get to trial stage. And there it was, you know, Metropolitan Police of London were found guilty of endangering the public health and had to, I don't know, pay some fine or something. But the sense of shock and outrage among the general public was really palpable about this. And I said something about this to the people I was staying with, and they said, well, I mean, would something like this fly in the States? And I said, are you kidding? Or where I live, they kill, the cops kill like 8 people a year. And they said, really, in the United States of America, the police kill about 8 people a year. And I said, no, Portland, Oregon, the police kill about 8 people a year.
Yeah.
And that was just met with disbelief. And like, they were just like, no, that can't be right. And I was like, no, really, I think something about this.
It's something we accept here to a large degree. And I don't say that lightly. I mean, even if we are outraged by it, the acceptance comes in the form of not fighting back. And there are people that do fight back, but generally it washes away very quickly, whereas there's no accountability here. That seems to occur in other countries, and I think it's starting to lose that. I think the police in other countries are patterning themselves after the American police force and American policing because they see how successful it is.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the model, the organization isn't becoming internationalized very much, but the models of policing and the strategy and the tactics and the mobilization are very much very quickly becoming internationalized. So that we see, we saw, you know, you were talking about crowd control earlier, we saw police around the world respond with different strategic approaches and different tactical deployments immediately following November 30th, 1999, with the WTO protests in Seattle. And we're seeing these sort of programs where, like, you know, the head of the tactical team they know when there's going to be, you know, a conference like that or, you know, some big to-do like that. And the head of the tactical team from, you know, some American city will go to those other countries just to observe.
Well, Genoa and GA, they brought in. They brought in American forces to
train.
To train,
there.
Right.
Right. Yeah, I believe it was the county sheriff sent a trainer to Genoa.
Well, he was the same Los Angeles County Sheriff that was sheriff during Rodney King, I believe, wasn't it? He still held this position.
I'm not sure, but it wouldn't surprise me.
We don't have Carl with the K here to Wikipedia it for us.
So we're pretty much.
We're just gonna pretend that we know the answer. Yeah, I mean, it was the same guy. So absolutely, 100%. This is media. What we say goes.
Yeah, exactly.
Same dude.
Talking heads. We're heads.
So, but yeah, so the model of policing is very quickly becoming internationalized, and it's not moving in the more humane direction. It's moving in the more militarized, more brutal direction.
Well, doesn't that go without saying? I mean, I've read some articles and some sections of your book, and basically, if I were to write the book, you spend a lot of time obviously researching the history of the police, and it's written in a very very intelligent fashion. It's somewhat academic in its language. It's meant to appeal to more than just the angry anarchist audience. It's meant to be somewhat of an academic study of the history of police. Is that wrong in saying that?
No, that's fine. I'm a little squeamish about the term academic.
Well, when I say academic, I just mean that you talk good.
Oh, well, thank you.
But you know, if I were to write a book like that, of course, it would be chapter one, fuck the police, because. Chapter two, they still suck. Chapter three, fuck them, motherfuck them. And then that would be the end of the book. It would be a prologue, and I would have the prologue written by Howard Zinn or some shit like that. And like, you know.
The appendix would.
No big deal.
The appendix would just say refer to chapter one, two, and three.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Why fuck them? Because they're the police. Yeah. Like, that'd be it.
Yeah.
But your book, you actually painstakingly go through the history of this. How hard? It's hard for me when I read single isolated reports, and I say isolated not because they're isolated incidents, but single reports about police brutality. How much shit did you have to fucking dig through, and how hard was that on your psyche to read about fucking cops for how many years did you study this shit?
A lot.
So a lot of years you studied fucking cops.
I mean, the project of writing Our Enemies in Blue grew out of my political work. I was doing work around police brutality issues for half a dozen years before that, and then I really. I guess I got tired of the sort of fuck the police level of it, and it, you know, I found, I mean, not that I disapprove of the sentiment, it's just that in doing the political work, I found that we were coming up across, like, real political questions that I didn't have the answer for, and the sort of rote anarchist line wasn't able to provide. And so I was like, well, okay, let's look at the scholarly literature, let's look at the professional literature, let's see, you know, what they say about these questions. And it turned out that their level of analysis was not much more sophisticated. It was, you know, yay, the cops, and that was pretty much the end of the story. So I really had to look into the, especially the scholarly literature, the professional literature turned out not to be very helpful. But even then, I mean, the typical way of writing a history of the police is you pick a city, you pick a period of time of less than a century, you say, you know, on this date, Chicago got a police department, here's how it was plagued with scandal and corruption for the first 100 years, thank God for the reform movement, everything's better, and you stop there. Or you date it far enough back that you can say, you know, you can end the story kind of early, and you don't have to.
So, do you find that in these writings you were studying, do they tend to paint police forces as being one time brutal, and at one time they were violent, but now things are better? Is that a general sentiment?
That's a tendency, yeah. I mean, there are scholars who are more critical of present than normal, but the typical narrative starts with, you know, corruption and brutality, and actually the typical narrative starts with this idealized night watch. That in dealing with the, you know, the plague of immigrants in the 19th century converted into a police force and then became corrupted by machine politics, and there was a long, brutal, bad time. But, you know, thank God we got out of that. And, you know, depending on who you're asking, it changes when we got out of it. The story I tell actually starts differently with not the Night Watch, but the slave patrols. And I think there are good scholarly, it's not just political reasons for that, there are good scholarly reasons for linking it that direction. And is basically a history of brutality and corruption unbroken to the present. And I...
unbroken, meaning...
meaning continuous.
Meaning it started based on the premise of being brutal, and it's never stopped.
Well, exactly. And you draw... one of the modern-day examples that you give is... This is an article from Eat the State, a fucking sweet website, by the way, you guys, from an article by Christian Greenscare, The State's Priorities in Day-to-Day Repression. And I'll just read the section. It says, this legacy continues today with routine police practices like racial profiling and quality of life campaigns against panhandling and sleeping in parks. These efforts have no impact on real crime, but they serve to remind the poor and people of color of their subordinate status, and to keep them under the continual monitoring and control of the criminal justice system. And we're also seeing this in the Netherlands right now. They're pushing through some legislation to ban squatting and make it punishable by a year or up to 3 years in prison if squatters refuse to leave. And ironically, that legislation is being led by the conservative Christians of the country.
I guess not,
that's
really.
What I would expect.
I guess the opposite.
Jesus was a squatter, man.
Talk a little bit more. I mean, is this, talk about, like, I find it intriguing, the idea of, like, just the day-to-day repression. And because one of the things that I really struggle with, my place of work, there's a bunch of police that come in there a lot. And there's a couple of the guys that, please don't beat me up, guys, but that come in there, man, and I kind of like them. They're like decent guys. They seem like. And but
I got a sandwich that's 2 feet long.
Yeah. I'm about to get beat up with
your fucking mouth.
So what I find the most disturbing, though, is I feel like that's what I was talking about earlier, like the face of legitimization that is an evil organization is actual, like, genuinely well-meaning people, maybe. And I'm disturbed by that to a great degree because they're cops.
Right. And so let me take these questions separately. I mean, first, I'll start with the satellite. Well, you know, some of them seem to be well-meaning, decent people. Then I'll go to the first one, which is the sort of day-to-day repression. I think most cops become cops with the best intentions of the world. Like, they have some idea of, like, dignity and protecting the vulnerable and, you know, ensuring order and maintaining public safety, and they bought the sort of heroic ideology. Unfortunately, good intentions aren't enough here. And the point of the kind of analysis I do in Iron Mason Blue isn't to judge particular people as being like good people, nice guys, bad guys, whatever. It's to offer an analysis of the institution and the way that it works and the function that it has in society. And one of the interesting things about institutions is that they have their own kind of logic, and they take on a life of their own, regardless of what the people who are part of it think they're doing. And so a lot of cops, you know, buy the ideology. I mean, I think it would be very hard for them to do their job if they got up in the morning and thought, okay, well, let's go, you know, keep down the poor today. You know, that it's much easier for them to face that if they have this self-righteous sense of, like, being misunderstood and wanting the best for people and whatever. One of the best pieces of evidence that has come out about this in the last few years is Norm Stamper, who used to be chief of police in Seattle. He was the chief of police who resigned in the middle of the WTO mess. And he wrote an autobiography where he talks about, like, being a kid and hating the cops and, like, being, like, this liberal and, like, hating the cops and, like, taking the civil service test in San Diego, and the job that came up for him was being a cop. And he thought, you know what, I'm going to do it. I'm going to be the good cop who respects people's civil rights and is, you know, serious about the rule of law and treats people with respect. And then he documents how within weeks he was lying in police reports, lying on the stand, beating people up for no good reason, and also the degree to which he took that sort of mindset home with him and was abusive to his wife and then his second wife and then his third wife and then, you know, drank too much and drank on duty and, like, the whole sort of gamut. And that it happened very quickly and without him noticing. And you know, once he got pushed out of the institution, like ex-cops sometimes say some interesting things about their career. Like once they get out of the institution, out of that framework, and have a chance to look back on it, there are some elements that sometimes appear prescient to them that they didn't recognize at the time.
I wonder if it's part of the populace's relationship to authority, like particularly in Western culture, or it's just like this this guy I just finished reading, his name's Sam Konkin. He died a couple of years ago, but he one of his things that he wrote in his little man is to look at the system as you have the few on top, and then you have the like 100 below them, then they've got 500, then you've got 1,000. You've got this like huge matrix of which is constantly kind of reinforcing the meme, which is that this is the right thing to be doing, this is how we do things, this is acceptable. And it seems to me that it's like this, it's a system of like incentives and disincentives is how I started thinking about it, like where there's, you know, say it creates crime and poverty and creates more of a need for security, which in turn creates individuals who see and do terrible things a lot, and so they're emotionally and mentally damaged. So it just kind of it plays into the whole premise of civil being kind of insane. You know?
Yeah. When you were saying about Stamper, it's interesting. I have a close friend who tells a story about one of his friends that has been decided as a kind of a joke and kind of an experiment that he was going to enroll in the police academy and take the training just to see what it was like. Like,
did he do it?
He did it on the internet. He did it. And within 2 weeks of being in the police academy, his partner was telling him, you have to fucking quit. You are becoming a domineering, authoritarian fucking prick. I didn't even realize it. He didn't even realize that somehow within that training that they can whip you into shape so quickly. And
contain themselves. I mean, they have certain norms that are internal to the institution, and they instill those norms in the people who make up the institution. And if they also do that, then the institution ceases to exist, right? So the people who can adapt themselves to those norms adapt to the institution, take on the sort of mind frame of the institution. People who can't get washed out. And so, you know, the question of sort of the question of the good cop, I always think it's useful to like look at, like, well, what happens to the ones who, like, really try to do it, right? What becomes of them? And for example, just take a local case. There was a fight outside of a bar downtown a few years ago here in Portland, and it was actually two off-duty cops who, like, took a dislike to some guy and beat the hell out of him. And when people went to break up the fight, they pulled out their badges and were like, you know,
I'm hey, Fingerman.
Right, exactly. Hey, back off. And then, you know, continued to beat the hell out of him. Somebody called, you know, the on-duty, not drunk cops, who showed up and immediately began the process of covering it up. Like, they talked the guy out of filing charges. They took his bloody shirt and threw it away. They talked to the other guys and got them to get their stories straight. And word came down from the high officer on duty in the middle of the night, a woman named Rosie Sizer, who is now our chief of police. Keep this off the books. Like, no reports, no records, nothing.
The people's chief.
Right. There was one sergeant.
Tell him a word.
Whose name I've unfortunately forgotten. But there was one sergeant who said, this is bullshit, and he went ahead and filed a report. And then he threw around Sizer to somebody else. So it landed on the district attorney's desk. They arrested these two off-duty yahoos. That cop had to be moved to a different precinct for his own protection.
Yeah.
And in less than a year, had put in for disability retirement.
Well, we've all seen at least 5 Denzel Washington movies where he plays a cop that rats out other cops. Like, this is all great for, like, you know, for setting aside an example of the good cop. I don't fucking care.
Well, my point is the institution can't tolerate it.
Well, of course. Of course not. Yeah.
Like, okay, so here's a guy who clearly, like, took it at its word, took it too seriously, thought that it had something to do with enforcing the law and justice and all that kind of stuff, and, like, tried to do what he thought was his job, and he was just wrong. That wasn't really the job. The job was what those other guys did to cover it up and to make
sure
it go away.
Call the institution. I mean, this is classic criminal organization. I mean, I don't even want to call it an institution. It's like it's the mob. I just watched this 9.5-minute montage of police brutality on free agents. And it was the kid who put it together called it the most dangerous street gang in America. And it's a 9.5-minute montage of, for instance, one girl in a drive-thru, the cop insists that he gave her a 20. She says, no, you gave me a 10. But she's like, you know, fuck the cops. They put my brother in jail. And eventually a cop comes in there and arrests, she's like 17, maces her and arrests her. I mean, that's mob mentality. That's not securing anything. That's just, that's, you know, and when you betray the mob, your safety is at risk.
I kind of have to disagree, though, that it's not an institution. I think it is. My definition or my idea or understanding of what an institution is something that exists even outside of concrete evidence that it's there. When you become institutionalized, you embody or bring into your own way of thinking the way that you are being told by the dominant forces. And I think the police are definitely an institution because the psychological warfare of just simply having police in existence, the ability of a group to fuck you up, to the ability that these people can fuck your life up, and hit you with a baton, I don't mean macing you, they completely destroy families and communities. Not even just their own families, which they're really good at fucking up their own families. Everybody who I know is the child of a cop, abusive childhood in some fashion. Their parents, whether it's male or female, just complete fucking rampaging asshole. But the institutionalization comes from our instant fear of whenever we think a cop might be present. Driving in our car and a cop gets behind us, we all kind of clench our assholes up a little bit. You know, we don't want to fart because we might get fucked up for farting. And you know, it's like that institutionalization, and this goes in further into how we confront the police. And I wanted to talk to you about this. You have cop watch.
Let's hold that for just a second because I wanted to bring.
Oh, I hate this show, motherfucker. We don't.
This is not a democracy.
Here I am, the law. Understand?
No, I did promise to come back around to the everyday repression, and you were right there.
Oh, yeah, everyday repression. Go for it. We're going down. We're going in the past.
It's like it's Christian's show now.
1.21 gigawatts.
Great Scott. We're good.
Oh, okay. everyday repression. One of the arguments that I make, maybe the main argument that I make in Iron Maiden Blue, is that in a way it's a mistake to approach the police, to try to approach an understanding of them with the assumption that what they're really about is the stuff that they say they're about. But what they're about is catching bad guys or enforcing the law or ensuring public safety or any of that, however you want to cash that out, like any of that sort of hero cop TV fantasy rhetoric.
Apology.
Like just forget that, because if you actually look at the law, it's a very weak guide to what the cops are actually going to do, either at the level of the individual officer or at the level of the whole institution. A much better predictor of what they're going to do is the real existing distribution of power within the society. So if you look at who has power and who lacks power, pretty predictably, it's not 100%, but pretty predictably, the cops are going to behave in a way that keeps the people who have the power in power and keeps the people without the power powerless. And that's mostly true at the level of, like...
Is that because the people in power are the ones that pay their paychecks and give them the level of authority that they now have?
I mean,
the powerless can't give you authority to do something. Only the powerful can give you a gun and tell you to do something.
Right. I mean, it gets to the... It's funny. I say, like, it helps fucking anarchists, because I say this other times that people are like...
Let it out.
Oh, well, that just can't be right. And I'm like, well, what does it mean to have power in a society if the main coercive institutions of the society don't protect your interests? I mean, that's, you know, if you look at it not from the interest of, not from the direction of what do the cops do, oh, they preserve power, but instead look at it from the perspective of, well, what does it mean to have power? Oh, well, it means that you have access to the institutions of coercion. Then it becomes immediately clear.
Right, for instance, 50,000 people in the streets of Seattle, 200 people inside of the buildings, police turn their guns on the 50,000.
Right.
Now, anyone would think that 50,000 people have much more power in that situation than 200 people, but quite obviously, not the case.
I mean, to take a different kind of example, I mean, one that specifically sort of breaks apart the legal requirement versus the real politics. When the law was explicitly racist. Police behaved in ways that protected white supremacy and made sure that it continued. When the law changed so that it is not explicitly racist, somehow the police continue to behave in ways that protect white supremacy and make sure that it continues.
Now, white supremacy is an institution as well.
Right. And, I mean, I think it's more than an institution. It's like the blueprint of the society.
Sure. I'd give you that.
But so, you know, here is a pretty clear case where, like, the change in the law doesn't actually have very much effect on what the cops do and the way they behave, because the location of power hasn't shifted.
Well, so it's reform. It's exactly what reform is. They'll give you this idea that you have a voice, or that we're going to change to cater to your needs, but in actuality, we're just going to reform the way that we act, or the way that we portray ourselves.
And this brings us back exactly to the good cop question of a few minutes ago, where in the course of the 60s and the 70s, you know, one of the theories as to why the police behaved in these racist ways was because racists become cops. And they thought, well, how do we do that? How do we get rid of this? Well, okay, so we'll have these we'll recruit people of color to become cops, which they've done fairly successfully. I mean, not here in Portland, but everywhere else.
Well, sure.
And they will screen to keep out the overt sadists and racist, which they do hit or miss. And they'll have sensitivity trainings and things like that so the cops can understand the, you know, life in the ghetto and all that kind of stuff, which they do for no real effect. Now, that those changes in practices have made no difference, really, in the main mission of the police, which is preserving white supremacy. And so in police departments like Portland, which is overwhelmingly white, every reliable study indicates that the police are more likely to stop and arrest and search and hurt people of color out of proportion of their relationship to the population. In places like Washington, D.C., where the police force is overwhelmingly black, it's still true that the police are more likely to stop and arrest and search and hurt people of color far out of proportion to their relation to the population. You can change the personality institution, and it doesn't change the overall norms of the institution.
I mean, so a black president isn't going to change the condition of black America.
Any more than a black police chief.
Yeah, sorry, guys. I didn't mean to let you down on that one.
I know we got a lot of voters in here. A lot of hope in the politicians. I mean, except on the whole notion that that the institution is there to create manageable demographics of crime and poverty.
Say more about what you mean. I'll tell you.
Well,
okay, you're perfect. It's your show.
Okay, sorry. That clip is going to play in a moment.
We edit in real time. I mean that, for example, the prohibition provides huge incentives to sell drugs and make a lot of money off of it on the black market, which in turn creates more crime, which in turn creates more of a need, quote unquote, for police, which is kind of one of the self-justification processes of the system. So if you are focused on a particular demographic a lot, you keep them in the system and you keep them flowing through, so you keep a focused, manageable demographic that fit your statistics of crime or sending a lot of people to jail or pulling a lot of these people off the street and can therefore legitimize the institution more, if that makes sense. So it's kind of the idea of putting enough people through the system, because once it starts statistically, a lot of people stay in the system for a long time.
I mean, there is a circular logic to it, and but it doesn't rely necessarily on – I mean, I think crime is a structural element of our society, and the kind of crime and the amount of reflects a lot about the way our society is stratified and the economics of capitalism. However, the focus on, for example, the black population in terms of the criminal justice system is vastly out of proportion to the black population's share in crime. And in fact, technical violations of the law that in white communities go unnoticed or sort of shrugged about or whatever, in black communities get, you know, the boot of the cops coming down on them. And so there, and then the place where the self-reinforcing starts is that once somebody is in the system, then things like parole violations become, you know, which involve behavior which would not even be criminal were it not for the fact that the person was on parole, suddenly become, you know, reasons for police intervention, reasons to return them to the court system, perhaps reasons to return them to prison, et cetera. And it plus, you know, once you've been to prison, it's much harder to get a job, much harder to get housing, much harder to ensure that your needs are met legitimately, you know, meaning legally here. And therefore, there does tend to be a structural recidivism based on lack of opportunity based in jail.
Which is what makes people like Fred Hampton, Huey Newton, and Malcolm X so fucking dangerous. When talking about liberation is one thing, talking about liberation from police repression is a whole other ball of wax, if you will. I don't know what that term means, ball of wax.
It really is a real thing, too. People say that.
It's a ball of wax.
I've never known what it meant.
But honestly, though, I mean, Mark Rudd, Bill Ayers, Bernadine Dorn, they blow up police stations or courthouses, and they get off on, yeah, which is fucking awesome.
Yay!
But they get off on the technicality. Fred Hampton, 22 years old, is probably one of the most eloquent leaders of his time, gets fucking gunned down in his sleep. You know, he didn't live to see 23. Mark Rudd, you can hang out with Mark Rudd right now. Just go to any liberal gathering, and Mark Rudd's going to be there saying to vote Democrat. 40 years ago, he's blowing shit up. It's the fact that he's white is basically the reason he's alive today, because you can't have a white speaker is not going to get up and galvanize the public to fight against police repression, because white America still doesn't have a necessarily a broad understanding of what that actually means, what police repression actually is. You get a black speaker up there. For instance, I think a good example is the black guy who recently had a loaded automatic weapon at a political gathering where Obama was inside, and when interviewed, he cited, well, the forefathers of this country gave me the right to bear arms, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, and it's like, wait a second. If he had said, Huey Newton or George Jackson or Fred Hampton told me I can carry this fucking gun, the motherfucker would have been shot down in the street, and there would have been no question, no media, nothing. But he quotes some rich guys, and all of a sudden it's like, oh, he's a proud, patriotic American. He'll go, goddamn Obama, bring your guns. This is a new world order, take over right now.
Don't tread on me.
But, you know, it's not just because he's black, but obviously he was a black man. He was carrying a gun. It was the idea that could not be, that had to be stopped for Fred Hampton. It was the idea of freedom from this police repression, because I think, this is not what I think, but if white America starts to understand what the police actually is for, they might start to fight against it a little bit. Black America is fighting against it. Hispanic culture, you know, Mexican culture in this country, they are fighting against it. Indigenous people have always fought against it. There's always been a resistance to the police in their neighborhoods. White America hasn't quite come around so powerfully yet. What do you think about that, Christian?
In general, I agree. I think that the race of the constituency is probably more important than the race of the speaker. I think because Fred Hampton had a black audience, and not just an audience, but a constituency, because, you know, the Black Panthers were organizing the black community,
sure.
That made them very, very dangerous.
And they were becoming self-reliant off of the system, you know.
And that made them very, very dangerous in the eyes of the authorities. Had they, you know, had Fred Hampton been organizing, you know, white college kids, probably he wouldn't have told. Probably they wouldn't have been as threatening. So I think it's more the status of the constituency rather than the status.
So,
or for that matter, if there is
now. That is changing. That's one aspect of this institution that's changing. Now, anybody who is organizing anybody is automatically deemed a threat. There's still inherent racism.
Some people more than others.
Yeah, there's still inherent racism that some people are getting off from away with more shit than others. Ivan Fred Hampton Jr. Went to prison for being on a frame-up, 40 years after his father was killed. There's still inherent racism. But so now a lot more of us are becoming enemies of the state, and not by our choosing necessarily, just simply by necessity. I don't know.
Well, I'm actually working right now on an essay about the domestic application of counterinsurgency theory, and part of the shift that's occurred is that the security forces still, go around hunting out conspiracies and looking for agitators and all that kind of stuff, but they're much less concerned with, unearthing the one red. Like, they used to have this idea that they could, just find the red who was, the agitator and, pull him out and the whole thing would fall apart. The idea was to find the agitator, expose him, and, everybody else goes back to being a loyal American. And the 60s made them rethink this quite a bit. And they've been learning to apply theory that was developed in colonial conflicts. And so they're looking less at picking out the individual people and more at mapping populations, looking at demographics, looking for the sort of the dangerous constituencies, and trying to manage whole blocks of people rather than just find the agitator and pull him out.
Sure.
So
I mean,
a much more sociological rather than conspiratorial model.
Right. Well, the right-wing conspiracy nuts, the pro-lifers, for instance, they're not that high up on the FBI's most wanted list. The highest domestic terrorist threat at this point is the ELF and the ALF. This is what our government states as the number one domestic terrorist threat in America is the Animal Liberation Front, who have never harmed a single human being.
And that says something about the state's priorities. That reflects, what it is that they think is important to protect. It happens. Human life just doesn't matter that much as far as we're concerned.
Oh, we're going to have some stuff you wanted to address from some of the articles.
Oh, sure.
But we're going to play a song right now about what we were talking about before. This is KRS-One, Black Cop.
Black cop, black cop, black cop. That's what them black people we are gonna drop. 'Cause don't even get the hate on my back. They take the M16
So that was KRS-One, Black Cop, from one of the greatest fucking hip-hop albums, or albums, period, of all time, Return of the Boom Bap. I remember getting that shit when I was like 11 years old. My brother was feeding me hip-hop albums to piss off my ultra-conservative Christian mother. And I would bump the shit out of some KRS-One, and my mom would get so... Did he just say fuck? We don't say fuck in this house. You just said fuck twice. Oh, that's pretty funny.
You know, when you said KRS-One, I totally thought... I was thinking you were going to play the band who sang... Who's the guy that sang Red, Red, Wine?
UB40?
Yeah, I was like, really? Them? All right. I mean, I guess they're radical.
Maybe they had an album I didn't know about.
And then even while it was playing, I was like, I don't think that's them.
Yeah. So what is this, a departure from their first album? This is their sophomoric effort.
I wanted to talk about like the we had one of our Facebookers, one of our Facebook friends, and by the way, you're not real friends, so you're Facebook friends. And we had one guy who wanted us to ask you how you think parents can explain the concept of police to their children.
Well, typically anarchist parents.
Right.
Well, not having any children of my own, and therefore being an expert on parenting.
You're an expert on being black against the cops. You're a non-parent who's an expert on parenting. This is awesome.
Yeah.
You're one of my favorite guests of all time at this point. Tonight on Burn, we have white privilege as a guest. So, I'm just kidding.
Well, whatever you need an expert on, I can tell that.
Well, you have glasses. So.
Glasses.
You have glasses. That makes you an expert.
That's all it took. If I'd known, I would have gotten them years earlier. I think, you know, part of it will just be a matter of being able to talk to your kids about the rest of society. You know, I mean, if they're raised with the sort of mythology of, you know, good guys and bad guys and the state is the traitor and all that kind of stuff, then it's going to be very hard to be like, except, you know, don't actually narc it down to the cops. If they're raised with a, you know, more sane view of the world they live in, and, you know, starting with, you know, the people they know, the people they care about, what their relationships are to things like work and housing and, you know, the law, and then like the police, then I think, you know, it may still be hard, but there, context is everything.
I recommend, as a parent of two radical anarchist children, not censoring yourself at all when talking to your kids about anything. Number one, your kids can understand, they can compute, and they will be able to communicate with you whether you believe that or not. But a really good tool is media that children enjoy and you enjoy. And the movie Chicago 10, which is an awesome animated film, I watched that with my kids and didn't feel bad about watching that with my kids because my kids watch whatever I watch. But they got a clear-cut understanding. We watched it shortly before I was going to a national mobilization of some sort. I forget which one. But it gave them an idea and an understanding of what that large-scale national protest was about. They'd been to protests before, but it was always liberal protests where, you know, the cops just stand there and let people walk by them. But they saw that film, and they understood really quickly. In fact, my son, who was 3 at the time, was like, so the guys in blue are the bad guys, right? I'm like, yes. And he's like, well, they should beat them up. And I'm like, and there it is. My kid understands cops in a nutshell. So, next.
Yeah, done. No big deal.
Right, whatever.
So, something I've been thinking about is the levels of emotion that, like, I go through whenever, you know, I've seen people in person getting beat up by cops, or I've been personally chased by cops at clubs at different functions, and seeing it on so much media, I have this, like, these levels of emotion that I go through that start with, like, just like puring at rage, where I want just as badly to see, I want to see that cop beaten up badly. I just want to see the shit get kicked out of him by someone who's bigger than him. I was YouTubing the other day. I was trying to find YouTubes of specifically cops just getting beat up by someone, you know.
There's a great one of this boxer getting pulled over. I'm serious. He's like 6'7", 350 pounds of pure muscle, gets pulled over by a cop, and the guy gets out of his car, and the cop shits himself. See the mere mass of this dude. And the cop says something and goes to grab at his gun, and the dude just throws a right hook, and the cop just fucking lays out, like, in a heart. Boop! It's like YouTube porn.
So then when I move through that catharsis and YouTubing and everything, I get to this point of asking myself, what's the incentive in the moment to do that? Like, what is it? In terms of human action, reacting to incentives and disincentives, and then I get to thinking about our relationship again to authority, because in my experience growing up, my parents, I grew up in a really strict religious household, and my parents presented themselves as objective moral authorities. And when I got to that area of my life, when I began to question that, it created emotional conflict. And then the same goes for when we get into public education, teachers are presented again as objective moral authorities. When we question that, they get upset, and it carries on into police. Like, what are the ways that we can kind of overcome this relationship? Because if four mall security guards get shot in a cafe, it's a tragic story, and whatever. But if four cops get shot in a cafe, people fucking freak out. You know what I mean? What are some ways that we can overcome this relationship, this kind of false relationship to authority?
Well, I think you're right that it has to do with our relationship to authority. I mean, part of what it means to have authority is that you can use measures that cannot be used against you by those that you use them against, right? So it's like all the casualties are supposed to be on one side, right? But the piece from Anarchy Now earlier kind of hit on this, where it was talking about how many people the police kill every year versus how relatively rarely the police are even hurt, much less die. And then the public response to each of these. And for one thing, the public response is often contrived, right? It has a certain propaganda value. I mean, the state funeral of the four cops in Washington State a couple weeks ago was, really highlighted this. It was very orchestrated, choreographed, spectacular sort of effort on the part of the state to pull public sympathy in one direction rather than another. And so I think, part of it is just recognizing that, and also part of, I think, familiarizing yourself with some of the actual, statistics, some of the actual evidence here. Because, I mean, the public as a whole labors under the delusion that policing is vastly more dangerous than it really is. I mean, it's actually, considerably less dangerous than collecting garbage.
Or like driving a cab, I think, is even.
Yes.
So being a citizen, apparently, because police kill a different amount of people than people that kill police. So it's more dangerous to be a citizen than it is to be a cop.
it's hard to say. I mean, the way the Bureau of Labor Statistics measures the danger of a profession is deaths per 100,000 workers. And for cops, it's in the area of about 15 or 16.
The low number.
For coal miners, it's in the area of about 24, 25. For timber workers, it's in the area of about 120. So relatively, okay, and to really put this in perspective, for groundskeepers, it's 12. So policing is a little bit more dangerous than running a hedge clipper. I think, getting out of our heads the idea that they're like these, super heroic people who are taking these risks on our behalf, et cetera, is a good step in that. I think also looking a little bit objectively at the interests that they actually serve and who they actually protect and how they do it also should help get rid of some of our uniform worship.
What's always interested me is when you go to mobilizations of any, the vast amount of authority that police even have over large gatherings of social protest. And You know, you'll have 10,000 marks will stand there and say, no, go that way, and 10,000 people will go that way without even, like, approaching or confronting the police. Now, of course, the anarchists are with the police. But if I always think of it like this. If we were in a bar and we're sitting there, some dude comes up, picks one of you up, and throws your face onto the table, just some dude, I would hope that myself and everybody else on the table would do their best to physically restrain and fuck that dude up, because that's out of line. You don't just grab somebody and throw them down. Now, a cop comes in and does that. We all step back and watch it happen and then file a fucking report. Like, why? What makes it so inherently different? And all of us do this. All of us, I want to say all of us. Like, I know that I still have it inside of me that I draw a distinction between a cop and just some dickhead. Not all the time. It's less and less now. But why do you guys think that? Why is anybody? I mean, audience, this is an audience participation thing. Why the fuck is it that we're scared of the police? It's not just because they have a gun, because any asshole at any time could have a gun. We walk through parking lots. 46,000 people a year die in car accidents or because of an automobile, and we walk on the streets without being afraid every day. Why is it when confronting police, who are inherently our fucking enemy, do what? Probably more dangerous. But why do we let that stop us? Like, there's just so many more of us.
Well, one of the differences between some asshole with a gun and a cop is that the cop has 1,000 other assholes with a gun, just a radio call away.
Okay, I'll give you that. Yeah.
There's a study done, it's like in basic psychology books. It was a study with prison guards and prison mates.
That was one where
it was an experiment that they did that they actually cut off early because some students pretended to be guards while others simulated being prisoners. And the people who became the guards ended up their colleagues, and it got really, really fucked up and really nasty. And the professor running the experiment had to stop it early because of how fundamentally these people changed. This was in an experiment.
Yeah, it's an experiment at Stanford Prison in the 1970s, Stanford University. It's called the Stanford Prison Experiment. They simulated a prison environment, and I write about this in my second book, America's Is About Torture. They arbitrarily sorted student volunteers into guards and prisoners, and things got out of hand almost instantaneously. I mean, it's hard to know what the experiment was supposed to show if things weren't going to get out of hand, but things got out of hand like almost overnight. And actually, the professor completely, again, going back to the norms of the institution, completely lost sight of his role and was like, wow, this is going really well. They're acting just like prisoners and guards. And it was an assistant professor
who hate each other. This is awesome.
Who hadn't been part of the experiment up and who entered in midway through was like, wait, you know this has to stop. Philip Zimbardo, his name is, he completely lost sight of what it was he was supposed to be doing. I think maybe more relevant here, there was a few years before that, there was a experiment done by Stanley Milgram, who was a social psychologist, I think at Columbia University. And he had this completely ingeniously simple experiment to evaluate the relationship between ordinary people and authority. And they asked for volunteers for the psychology experiment, and they like put an ad in the paper. And so literally they just got people off the street who were like, yeah, I'll spend an hour and get $5 and like help the cause of science. And here's what they did. So you come in and you say, well, what we're going to do is we're going to run an experiment that will test the effect of pain on memory.
Oh, right. I've heard
and so that. What you're our friend here is going to try to recite lists of paired words that are just arbitrarily put together. And every time he messes up, what you're going to do is you're going to administer an electric shock. Now, Milgram went into this with the idea that overwhelmingly everybody would say, no, I'm not. I'm not going to have any part of this. Are you crazy? This sounds terrible.
And they went button crazy.
And then when there's the one guy who would be like, okay, let's go. Then they know that they found the kind of person who can commit atrocities, and they could investigate his psychology. Well, what actually happened was that everybody sat down and was like, okay, when do we start? And would at least start the experiment, and 80% of people would go all the way through to the highest level, to like turning the volume all the way up.
And there was
hit to a buzzer, and the other volunteer was an actor who was just,
And they would also, wouldn't they also claim that it was, well, these were the instructions from the guy in the lab coat, so it wasn't really my fault that I was pushing the button to shock
my friend. Good German.
And
80%.
And a lot of them would say, would object, would threaten to leave, etc. And the guy in the lab coat standing there would say, well, this is what the experiment requires, and keep doing it, despite the stress was causing them, despite their own objections, despite, you know, feeling that it was wrong. The main conclusion of the Milgram experiment was that the deference for authority in American is overdeveloped. And that, I mean, and these weren't people who were institutionalized, really. These weren't people who had been trained. These weren't people who had been, like, indoctrinated. These weren't people who were committed to the logical
process. I wouldn't say any of that. I would say we're all trained and we're all documented. We're all institutionalized.
They weren't specifically.
Well, they weren't assigned a badge and they weren't assigned any kind of advantage. We've all been indoctrinated.
Self-selected, but they weren't indoctrinated into a particular institution. They weren't, you know, assigned a role. They weren't given the chance to, like, develop the personality type that was needed for that particular role.
Well, it just shows you how this culture is.
Exactly. And so imagine if they had been. Imagine if they went through 6 weeks of basic training. Yeah. And then
what they'd be capable of after that.
We're told, okay.
Imagine if they had that and Kung Fu. Fuck.
Fucking shit. Fucking love Kung Fu.
We only have a few minutes left with the guests, and we want to have a song on real quick. I want you to talk about Cop Watch. You're working with Cop Watch, and explain to our audience, both live and what Cop Watch is.
Okay, I'm a member of an organization here in Portland called Road City Cop Watch, and there are different Cop Watch organizations all around the country, cities all around the country. There are actually a couple here in town. They work independently. There's not like one giant Cop Watch headquarters that licenses the franchises and that kind of thing. So there's a lot of variance between the different organizations. And
what is the basic idea?
But the idea is basically that if organized groups of people take the job of observing the police when they do their work, that the police are going to behave less harshly than they would if nobody is watching. And in the cases where the police behave harshly anyway, then you're better documented what happened for the sake of, you know, the legal defense or filing a lawsuit and all that kind of stuff for the person who was harmed. And so the idea is organized groups of people observe the cops, and the theory is that that will change the way the police behave.
So it's not necessarily a confrontational group that confronts police. Actually, they kind of try to stay back a little bit, allow the police to do their job, but they film and document everything the police is doing. The idea is to avert a potential, and it takes place in neighborhoods where there's a lot of police violence, generally. You generally don't go to Lake Oswego and hang out and watch how cops act at the fucking food hands.
Or when they're telling the party to be quiet.
But this is in Northeast Portland. This is where...
Different groups have different strategies of how they do it. I mean, there are a lot of groups that aren't specifically cop watch groups that do cop watch type activity. I mean, like the National Lawyers Guild sends legal observers to demonstrate, but they pretty much only do it at demonstrations. They don't do it in neighborhoods. You know, so there are different strategies, there are different tactics based on, you know, the politics of the organization. We when we do it, we tend to pick neighborhoods that are particularly police affected. Our style is completely hands off. Like we stay back, we stay out of the cops' way, but we document what they do. And you know, it's hard to measure what effect it would have because we don't know what in case by case, like what would happen if we hadn't been there. But anecdotally, I've heard from a lot of people that the tone of the interaction dramatically changed as soon as we showed up. And we've also, there have definitely been times where we've shown up and the cops were starting to dig through somebody's car and they just put everything back and shut the doors. And, you know, not to suggest that perhaps that was a bad search and they were worried that people might notice, but...
In Tucson with Cop Watch, we were doing it for a while, and we found that what was happening was police would not drag a motor, beat them up, for instance, or somebody stopped outside of a bar. They would turn their aggression upon Cop Watch, and they'd come and knock the cameras out of our hands, and instantly you got a person who may have had some weed in his pocket that could have gone to jail for the night is walking away while the cop's kicking shit out of some anarchist with a video camera. And there was a small success there. an ass still got kicked, and a cop still went home that night and slept like a fucking baby.
But someone's pot was safe, and that is the moral of really any work life.
Jeff,
you have a question, brother?
Well, if your job included beating people up, though, that would be different. Okay, just for the listeners, the question is, for the listeners on the radio, the question that Jeff is asking is, what positive aspects can we take to counter or work with, are you saying work with the police or counter what the police do? Not just negative things, but what kind of positive actions can take place?
Well, questions of people like us. Because maybe they are individually, but, you know, again, to take the example, like, if a guy came in and, like, grabbed him and threw him down and, like, handcuffed him out, I think most of us would stop and question that and perhaps intervene. Whereas if a guy with a badge does that, then, or at least we'd be expect the norm is that we should, right? Whereas if a guy with a badge comes in and does that, is that we should sit here quietly and, like, maybe politely why that happened later. I mean, they're part of this institution that has a very particular function in the society. And politically, I'm opposed to...
But as a vet, Jeff, can I ask you something? As a vet, do you recognize the inherent against... another person, if you had to kill somebody when you were in Somalia, especially an innocent person, when I say innocent, I mean a person that didn't have a gun pointed at you, you know that that's wrong, and that's bad, and you recognize that, and you step away from that. There is a role to fill, there is a function, but you can recognize that. Well, I'm asking, can you recognize that that role and that function is fucked up and doesn't necessarily need to be there?
Well, right, I hear what you're saying.
Right.
Every fucking cop in the goddamn country. So what people can do it, and thank you for keeping doing that. But at the end of the day, they're still killing people, and people still hate the cops. So as long as we hate the cops and the cops keep beating people up, there's never
going to
be a change because
we're not working with them. Dude, I have you guys. It's funny shit to watch. Go to YouTube and look up the Love Police, and you'll cringe. But it's funny as shit because these guys, what they do is they hug police. And it's fucking hysterical. Some of the, you know, and this is where you can see some of the humanity, and it's, you know, it almost makes it more disturbing because some of the guys are just like, there's somebody still there, and they kind of grin, and they think it's funny. But then there's these other cats, man, that they're like gritting their teeth and staring off into space while some guy comes and physically touches them and hugs them and says, hey, man, everything's okay, right? And, you know, I think that is an active way to do something that can... You know, that can be a positive way.
I got to say real quick that I wish that there was some way that we could positively...
I used to work in homeless kids, see a kid. They have this thing in there called Donut Dialogue. And basically, the first thing of its kind in the entire nation, basically, the captains and lieutenants and all of the Seattle police get together and hang out with homeless kids for 8 hours in their squat. They bring donuts, they bring pizza, they bring coffee, and...
they let these kids get to the cops. For the first 3 hours, they got nothing decent to say, and the cops said they were taking, you know? But they've been doing this for like 6-7 years now, and it gets to the point now where you've got these relationships between people at Capitol Hill and these police.
Well, I think the aspect of that that's missing from Islands with Police is that there is a relationship built on a human personal level. Now, when we're dealing with police, we're not dealing with the neighborhood cop that we all know his name. And, you know, for instance, okay, but you're still talking about 3 hours the cops are taking abuse from these people, verbal abuse, and then putting up with it and building a relationship. But that's not what we're dealing with in the street. First of all, do that with us in the streets. They would not take the time, and I wouldn't take the time. I'll be honest, because they wouldn't, because it wouldn't serve their purposes. It would not serve their purposes. On a small scale, okay, but hold on a small scale, this can work as a social experiment. But this is not the society as a whole, and first of all, I think that we need to recognize what our relationship to the police is and establish what your relationship, not our as a group, your personal relationship to the police is. That's where you can decide how you need to act and react to police action. Until you decide that, then you're going to be working off of a paradigm that's not necessary or inherent. So once you decide what your relationship to the police is, then you can act accordingly. I have decided, based upon years of experience with these motherfuckers, that my relationship to the police is going to be inherently negative, and it's going to be confrontational because I don't understand, I don't allow for that level of authority to be exerted upon anybody by anybody else. I don't exert that authority upon anybody, and I highly expect the same. So motherfuck this, my personal relationship. Now, I'm not giving answers for the community. I'm saying if you want to know what you can do, maybe it would work for you to talk to a cop. Maybe it would work for you to sit down and have coffee with them. Maybe it would work for you to try to come to an understanding. But that's not going to change the paradigm of what police's purpose are either. The police's purpose is to...
My earlier point. I don't care if they're good people. I mean, the point isn't to judge, well, are they good guys, are they bad guys, are they nice, are they mean, you know, whatever. The good people do bad things all the time.
Absolutely.
Well then,
doing an ideological like utopian dream. If we could simply pop and he'd sit down and have it with us, I am not opposed to positive action. I love positive action. I love it when it's community garden. People have dances. I love it when people get naked and scream together in a positive way. But experience, I'm telling you my experience. I'm not parlaying a law here. I'm saying my experience tells me that I am never going to be able to have a naked dance party vegan potluck with a fucking cop. Ever. And nor would I talk to you because that cop, whether that person did it himself or not, represents an institution that beats up my friends, that imprisons my friends, that tears apart my friends' families, and that fucking has to go. So that girl wants to represent that gang, the motherfucker, you're going to get the brunt of it too. If you want to take off your badge, sit down with me as a human being, quit your fucking job. If you understand that your job is fucked up, quit your fucking job. If you knew, for instance, that your job was responsible for the death and the punishment of thousands of people a day, I don't think you would be a barista anymore.
So if you give me attitude, I'm going to give you attitude. If you come in here for 10 days straight and give me shit because I happen to be at the reason, you're a fucking fool.
Exactly.
Some dude or some chicken in a fucking car, you're a fucking shit. Well, when you set out,
them. I don't care. I'm sorry, but my experience is not based on theoretical discussions.
Nine times out of ten, dude, any of y'all can fuck with the cops, dude. I got y'all beat on that, dude. So that's what I'm saying. What can we do? Positively.
What we can do is we can form communities that trust each other. We can talk to our neighbors and trust with our neighbors. So when an instant something does come up, we don't have to call the cops. We can avoid calling the police every single fucking situation possible. What? When did I ever say I'm saying form relationships with your neighbors? I didn't say go kick some judge and jury. Well, when I go to a mobilization and that thing in front of me and the institution which is in question right here, that cop is chewing my ass. Keep in mind, I don't go to a protest with a sub-automatic machine gun and fuck turtle gear because I don't own those things. If I did, I would.
That'd be sick.
I would fucking awesome.
Dude, I would be a ninja
for so. And I had that fucking... But I don't have that shit.
That was Donatello,
nor do
by the way.
We're running out of time here, but we're going to keep this show going. We're going to keep this conversation going, if everybody's okay with that. If you want to take off, you can.
Sure.
People want to take off. Leviticus, are you okay with keeping the conversation going? It's getting pretty hot. So,
I was not trying to make
you pulled the race card, Mosley. I know. I understand that. Right. First of all, I don't focus on race politics. I talk about race politics when it's pertinent, because it is pertinent to talk about race politics. And just because I'm a white male doesn't preclude me from that my black friends and my black family are under the gun more than I am. My Uncle Rufus, he's fucking raised me as a kid. I'm not going to pull this like personal history shit. We're talking about the simple ideas of white versus black paradigm in the anarchist community and people talking shit. Just because I'm not a black male doesn't mean that I don't get to say that it's fucked up that the police target black men before they target anybody else. And that's a fucking fact. The police do target men before anybody else. I don't have answers for how we fix it. Like I said, you have to decide what your relationship is and work from that point. That's my. If you ask me how to fix it, that's how we fix it. We decide what our relationship is and act accordingly. My relationship is I'm a fucking enemy of them because they've declared that. They've called war on us since day fucking one. And we are starting to wake up that we are being attacked in this war, the social war, the psychological war, the spiritual war, this war for the land base, all these wars. Anybody who stands with me is an us. When we speak about we and us, we're talking about anybody that agrees with us. So if you don't, then that's fine. But that's what us means. When you use the terms us or we, you're talking royally by saying that those who agree with what I'm saying are being spoken for right now. Obviously, I'm not going to speak for anybody else. I'm going to speak for me. But when I use terms like we and us, I'm talking about the we and the us who aren't speaking right now, who agree with this and feel this sentiment. So when I say us, there are an us and there is a they. And they have declared war on us years ago. And we are just starting to wake up to this fact. So if we choose to fight back accordingly, whether that's positive or negative is something we could talk about, but the fact that we need to fight back is the pressing issue. How we're going to do it is going to have to be decided by individuals or groups, but it has to be fucking done.
Right. I know it has to be done, but I'm just saying, it's like, on one hand, we target other nations for doing stuff, and
we target other nations because it's in corporate interest to target other nations. The same reason that the cops target us on the streets, because it's in their corporate interest to target us on the street. That's why. It serves the masters, which is whoever their master is, whoever the boss is, whoever his boss is, and whoever their boss is. And you go down the line and you have to follow the money here. You have to follow those that stand to profit. And there are those that stand to profit from us being poor. There are those that stand to profit from us being in prison. There are those that stand to profit from us being on work release and making minimum wage on third shift at Jack in the Box, which you can't even feed your fucking family with. And you have to do it because you have to pay rent to the landlord and you have to have a job for your PO. That's fucking slavery. I don't care what the fuck anybody says. That's slavery. Fuck that. It needs to be fought. If we want to talk about liberation, we have to talk about self-liberation first. We can't liberate somebody else. We are not some kind of force that comes in and liberates somebody. We liberate ourselves and, upon doing so, create the format of liberation. That's my feeling.
I'm sorry to
monopolize.
But I don't think we're going to end up in a non-combat situation. Like, I don't think we're going to
Palestine can't invade Israel, number one. Palestine can't invade Israel. Israel exists by invading Palestine. Palestine can't. It is violence. I agree, but we have to understand. We're going to talk about these things. We have to understand that while you may see it that I hate cops, that I'm talking hatred, I'm actually saying I love my freedom, and I love my family, and I want to spend time with my children and not go sit in a fucking jail cell based on my ideas. And Eric McDavid's serving 20 fucking years based on an idea, not based on a physical crime, and he's not the only one. There's fucking thousands of people serving prisons based on a fucking idea. And if these motherfuckers want to jail me or my friends, then me acting against them is not acting out of hate of the oppressor, it's acting out of love of my family and my friends and the oppressed. The act is done with love. It's because I cop because it's fun. I fight them because I fucking have to. And I think that just makes sense.
No,
I think we act nonviolently every day. I think 99.999% of my activity and my form of protest is nonviolent. The way I hug my friends and love my friends, the way that I talk about the things I believe in, all of that is nonviolent. And nonviolence is great as a form of resistance. It's the best form of resistance. However, when it comes to being attacked, there comes a time when you have to fight back, and hopefully that doesn't happen every day, and hopefully it doesn't happen when people are killed, but we have to understand that nonviolence is the way we live. Violence is something we do when we absolutely fucking have to, and then we have to respect that violence is a tool that can be used. It doesn't have to be used in all cases. I don't expect everybody here to be a fucking cop. I'd be very sad because everybody here that went out and punched a cop would be in fucking prison tomorrow. That would suck. However, if you're getting taken down on the street for something, I would hope that you feel okay with defense, and I would hope you understood that I'm going to be there to defend you, and I hope vice versa. And that's the understanding. Do what?
What if you've actually done something wrong, though?
Okay, I don't understand what. Wrong against who? Wrong against the person I'm doing something wrong to, and their family and their friends have the ability to justify any type of reaction. I don't think that some asinine third party with a gun paycheck has the ability to come and decide who gets to go down for what. 99.99%, again, I love these statistics, crime is done against property. Who the fuck got hurt in a graffiti incident? Who the fuck got hurt in some shoplifting? Who the fuck got hurt in any of these cases? However, these people get thrown to the fucking ground, they get their face slammed in the concrete, and you go to protest, and these people aren't breaking any laws, and they're getting their asses kicked. Dude, in Pittsburgh, we got our fucking asses beat in the street. I lost hearing in my right ear from their LRAD. I was doing everything by their fucking book. Now, when we do things by our fucking book, all of a sudden it's twisted around that we're some violent organization. Well, you created the war, and you're calling me a fucking insurgent? Motherfuck you. You came into my life. I didn't come into yours. I wasn't born into your world. I didn't come into your house and tell you how to live. You came into my fucking head and told me how I have to live. Yeah, there's a goddamn resistance. Not you. I'm not pointing to anybody in the room, by the way. I'm not pointing out at anybody here. Like I'm saying, you know, the metaphorical you and the mystical we.
I mean, I think our guest Christian put it really well. To end state oppression, we must change the very society. To end state oppression, we must end the state.
Are we back to me?
Yeah, we should protect ourselves from this, but like, at the end of the day, is that we're not fighting people, we're fighting an institution, we're fighting an authority that
that's brainwashing people to be a
Jew. Absolutely, but there's still people there too. Hey, we all know that recycling would have stopped Hitler. So that's our new argument. Shorter showers and recycling, a strongly worded letter would have stopped it. But, again, by the same token, I want to take the devil's advocate somewhat. Bonhoeffer killing Hitler wouldn't have changed Nazism. It wouldn't have changed control because this is a... Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. No, I think there's no argument to that if you're being attacked. But, okay, here's this. Try this. And I'm sorry I'm dominating, but I like to talk a lot, and people can interrupt me all you want. Here's the idea, then. We have to understand when we're being attacked. And if you don't think you're being attacked, then bad. But if you understand that you are being attacked, then fight back accordingly. Now, I have an understanding of being attacked in a much different way than somebody else might. I see that my river's being polluted. I see that all the food being genetically engineered. I see the skies getting filled with toxins. I see people going to prison for bullshit reasons. I see the fact that prisons exist is bullshit. I see all these things as what they are to me, a fucking attack. Thereby, everything that I will do in my life against those things is a counterattack. It's a defensive of resistance. It's not revolutionary ideology to overthrow and replace the power structure. It's saying, get the fuck out of my head, get the fuck out of my water, get the fuck out of my kids. Boom.
Which is absolutely
justified. Yeah, and nonviolence, I think, is the best way because it's possible, but it's not always possible.
Christian, what do you think?
How did we end up here?
Why didn't we do this hour ago?
No,
on the show.
We need more mics.
I mean,
like,
just
I think it goes vice versa. I think that the him and us was created by the power structure that's enforced upon us. I don't know, who knows, chicken and egg, fucking, you know, steak and hamburger. Who knows?
They feed each other. They're no longer part of that community.
I get the two
though. They're no longer part of it.
Christian?
What was the question? I think there are actually, I say that only half facetiously, I think there are actually questions that we're sort of fumbling around with. On the one hand, there's this question of the police institution and what we do with it. And on the other hand, there's this question of the police individuals and what we do with them. And it's important to keep those separate questions because the opposition to police shouldn't be just based on being the cops. I mean, you know, I don't necessarily like the people at the DMV either, but their role in society is somewhat different. The opposition to policing is a political opposition. It's based on what the institution does in the society, the influence that it has, the effect that it creates. Those are political questions. They have nothing to do with whether, you know, the particular people are fun to be around and, like, you can have your naked vegan dancing potluck or whatever it was you were talking about before. On the other hand, there is this real question of, like, okay, so we have these people who are in this institution who do bad things on behalf of the institution, and what kind of like, what kind of attitude do we take to them? And I think that's a real question, but I think it's a different question. And, you know, I mean, I think on the one hand, just outright anger and hatred is justified based on their participation in the institution. On the other hand, I think that, you know, maybe, maybe there's something to be said for, you know, compassion and reintegration into the community and all that kind of stuff. But the compassion and reintegration in the community can't come at the expense of the political project of dismantling this fucking institution. Did I answer?
Yeah.
Does somebody want to yell at me now?
What I do want to say before this stops recording for the DAO streaming live, but I do want to say real quick, I don't want to break away from the subject because this is awesome, but I do want to say next week we have a really big show. Franklin Lopez from Sunday TV is coming into the house to do a fundraiser for his amazing film, InCiv. You can see clips of it at InCiv.com. That night we have Ward Churchill, Derek Jensen, John Zerzan, David Rovics, Nako, A Medicine for the People, Seth Martin, and a stripped-down performance of some holy, holy, holy stuff. All next Sunday here, so please tell your friends, come listen on the show. It's going to be a PayPal-a-thon for anybody that's not here, but it is a fundraiser, guys, so scrape up any extra money you have and please help Franklin finish this film because he's doing amazing work, and I'd love to see this film get completed, and he's spending his own money to fly everyone. He's okay with that, but he's out of it right now. He's out of money, so we want to keep him flying around to film the shit that needs to be filmed for this film, and you've been, Christian, actually, to who you are through It's the End of the World as We Know It and I Feel Fine. So Franklin is the one responsible for all this shit.
You can make him pay for it next week.
Yeah, please come. Please listen if you're on the show and you'll hear how to donate online, or if you're here, donate in person if you can. But don't not come if you don't feel like you can donate. Obviously, let's make it a fucking party. Have a great time. Dance our asses off. It's going to be a lot of fun. And we have some important ideas that are going to be thrown around. I don't want to say we have important guests, because I think we're all important. You know, I do think we need more microphones. It'd be fucking awesome. I wish we could afford that one of these days. But anyway, back to the discussion.
And if you dislike me, you'll fucking hate him.
Hey, who?
Franklin.
You hate Franklin?
No. If you dislike me, you'll hate him.
Oh, he dislike you. Well, Franklin's fucking hilarious. He's awesome. But yeah, I think this is great. Jeff, do you mind if we hang out while we close up here and keep the discussion going? We're gonna wrap up the stuff up here with the microphones, but I think we can keep talking about this. And just while you do that, why don't we all grab chairs and cups, whatever needs to be taken up, help clean this place up a little bit. And I want to give a big water person. Yeah, broom and a mop are needed to be used.
Thanks everybody for coming tonight. Have a great week. We can't wait to see you next Sunday. It's going to be a lot of fucking fun.
Yeah, and I just want to say real quick also before we say goodbye, is Jeff, maybe the reason that you heard Fuck the Police so much in this episode is because I named this episode Fuck the Police. but it's a two-hour-long show, and we're not going to come up with solutions. We're just going to come up with sparks of conversation, so let's take this, because I like this conversation, and let's roll with it. Thanks so much, Christian, for coming.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fuck the Police.